Hey there, everybody. This is Super Ty, and this is Taiwan On, and I'm hanging out with my good friend, Cully Hamner.
How's it going?
That's going well, buddy. So I want to do a little side note here. You're the one that actually came up with the title of Taiwan On, so thank you.
You're welcome. I'm creative like that.
Excellent. So if you guys aren't familiar with this podcast, basically I sit with somebody who's either in the comics industry, somebody who's comes to the shop, or you know somebody who works with me, and we have a couple of beers and we just talk comics the entire time. So Cully, let's just start off. What's your what got you into comics?
You know, I've always read comics. I read comics when I was very, very small. I might even have learned to read from comics. But I don't remember not ever looking at them, you know, and at some point it just clicked in my head that somebody has to draw these things and that they must get paid to do it. So that's kind of the root of the whole thing. And it was always an aim when I was growing up, even when, you know, I wanted to do other things like, you know, I entertained the idea of being an actor at one point, entertained the idea of being a singer at one point, you know, like in a band or something, but comics was kind of always there, and everything I wanted to do was kind of a long shot. So, like comics was actually, in my mind, the shortest of the long shots.
That was the attainable goal.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
I gotcha.
And so, you know, and I drew a lot just for fun, and I've always been someone who has been fascinated by storytelling. So I just sort of naturally gravitated towards it. I got out of high school and immediately started working on a portfolio and going to conventions and that sort of thing. By the time I was 21, 22, I was starting to get some notice, and I got into comics, and I've been doing it ever since.
Right on. Okay, yeah. So for people that aren't familiar with your work, what was the first thing you ever
did? Who on earth would not be familiar? I'm just kidding. Well, I mean, the first thing that I was kind of known for was a comic called Green Lantern Mosaic, which came out in 1992.
Okay.
And that featured the John Stewart Green Lantern character.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, oddly enough, I'm still known for that. Like, I still sign a bunch of those all the time. In terms of what I'm doing, like, the last 15 or 20 years, what everybody would know would probably be... The first thing would be Red, which was made into a film with Bruce Willis.
Right, right.
The other thing would probably be Blue Beetle,
mm-hmm.
Which I designed and co-created along with John Rogers and Keith Giffen. Beyond that, probably, I guess I would say The Question. I've done a fair amount of The Question with Greg Rucka.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably what people would know me for most recently.
Right on.
So yeah.
So for people that like want to get into the comics industry, you know, how did you weasel yourself in there? How did you
You know, I don't, you know, people ask me this question and it's you can hear my dog in the background.
Yeah, dog's in the background.
That's Bernie. People ask me this question and I don't know the answer to it, because for one thing, no two people that I know have the same story of how to get into comics. And not only that, I broke into comics 25 years ago.
Right.
So it's like everything has changed on a technological level so much, on a cultural level so much, as far as how comics are viewed within the larger culture. And I don't know how to break in 2016 or 2017. I would basically say that what you need to do is you need to draw a lot.
Right.
You need to not only draw a lot, but you need to pay attention to storytelling, because it's actually about, it's more about storytelling. A lot of people think being a comic book artist is about being able to draw.
Right.
And really what that is it's a means to an end. You don't draw to draw, you draw to tell a story. So if you're someone that's going to you know, just do a lot of single image type, you know, illustration type things or whatever, it's not really going to get you very far. It's more important to be able to tell a story and you know, to do four or five sequential pages and show them to editors and people who can hire you, but also importantly show them to other artists, because artists are going to be your best critics and your worst critics.
Right.
Most editors aren't artists. Most editors, you know, I hate to say it, aren't storytellers in the same way that practically artists and writers are. So if you're gonna try to break in as a comic book artist, You need to talk to writers and artists. If you're going to be try to break in as a writer, you need to talk to writers and artists.
Right, right, right.
And this is something I'm dealing with right now. DC is doing a series of workshops. They're trying to develop their next kind of generation of talent. And one of the things that I had said to them when they asked me my opinion about it was that I really, because they had asked me if I wanted to maybe do a little teaching. And my thing was, I would love to do that. I don't necessarily know that I have much to say to artists, because most of the artists that are going to be in this program are at least pretty close to professional anyway. I mean, you know, they're really kind of at that point where they're going to be professional at a professional level pretty soon, whether they take a class or not.
Right.
I would rather talk to a room full of writers and talk to them about how to work with artists. And I would rather them have a writer talk to a room full of artists for the same reason, because that's a big thing. Go ahead.
No, I'm interrupting you. But that was one thing I wanted to bring up. You know, I know a lot of writers in town, but you're one of the few artists that I know. And so I wanted to talk to you about, like, the best way I could put it is, like, the disconnect between a writer's mentality and an artist's mentality. You know, I like what you're saying, that an artist in the comics is doing, you know, storytelling. It's not just drawing fancy pictures.
Well, sure. And, you know, the thing is, it's like I have some experience in comics writing also. I'm doing a lot of it actually right now. I can't say the project that I'm working on, but
of course.
But the disconnect seems, and this could be totally just my point of view, it seems larger than it used to be.
Okay.
Because when I came into comics, they were still doing things somewhat close to what they used to call Marvel style. And what Marvel style is that the writer would hand the artist essentially a plot or a synopsis of the story,
mm-hmm.
or basically like a breakdown page by page of just basically what happens. The artist would then take that and break it down into actual visual storytelling. Then the writer would come in and write dialogue sort of adapted to what the artist has drawn.
Oh, interesting.
It is a very collaborative way of telling a story, and what you ended up with was writers who knew when to boil what was happening in the story down to what needed to be there and had a good visual sense. And you had a lot of artists who were really good storytellers, who really had developed that skill beyond just drawing into pacing and character and having the characters act and that sort of thing. And in a lot of ways, that's gone. Because what you've had is you've had a lot of people come into comics from other media, film, television, prose, and you end up with this sort of like a version of a screenplay or a version of what they do in other media.
Mm-hmm.
And the artists are just expected to draw what's written.
Sorry. I saw a lady dragging a tire outside. It kind of threw me off,
yeah,
but continue.
That
continue.
Happens.
Continue.
And you end up with sort of like a separation of the jobs, and you get to the point where you've got screenwriters who essentially are doing the same thing that they do when they write a screenplay, which is too much has been made of the similarities between comics and movies. They're really not as pronounced as I think a lot of people
I can agree with that
want to make them. And you end up with a much less collaborative process, and you end up with writers really kind of not talking to the artists, and artists kind of feeling like their job is to just fill a shopping list of images that the writers want.
Right.
And that's really not how, in my mind, it should work. It's not how it used to work.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we can talk all day about, you know, whether it's better or worse, but I don't think anybody can deny that some of the greatest comics ever made were made with that process.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like Fantastic Four, you know, I remember the process you were talking about.
Stan Lee is the one that came up
with
this
process.
Yeah,
he just, like, came up with, like, a general plot, and Jack Kirby was just like, okay, well, let's get this, hash this out.
Stan would do it in a much less detailed way than it even became when I started. He would I mean, he would hand these guys like two or three paragraphs and say, go to town.
Yeah.
Sometimes, from what I've heard, he would even just act it out in the office. And the artist would take notes and go home and just draw the damn thing.
Oh, man.
So it's like, that changed a lot. By the time I broke in, you know, I would work with a writer and they would hand me what they referred to as a plot, which would be just a page-by-page synopsis.
Yeah.
Of what was happening. Maybe some dialogue suggestions, but still we're talking about a paragraph or two per page.
Mm-hmm.
And I would go and I would break it down into storytelling, and that's where I learned my craft. And in the time that I've been in comics, especially the last, you know, 10 years or so, that has just evolved out of comics. It's very rare nowadays. It's something I would like to see come back. But even so, it's like, I think that hopefully with these classes that DC is doing, if they're going to have me involved in them in any way, I can sort of advocate for that. I have a little bit already. But, you know, honestly, I think one of the reasons why they asked me to participate in this is because, you know, is because I'm sort of from that era, that last sort of era that did this.
Yeah.
And you know, I guess it's not all that common to find an artist who can kind of vocalize it or whatever. So that's kind of my thing.
Interesting. So one thing, we're going to pause for half a second here. Pause in just a bit. Actually, we don't got to pause a bit. We actually got a new guest star, which is Bernie the dog. It was very sweet.
Bernie.
You might hear the jingle jangling in the background. One thing that I wanted to also ask you about is, like, I've seen your studio just now, about 10 minutes ago.
Right.
So I noticed that you're still doing, like, the pen and ink style.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, blue pencils and stuff. So what is your opinions on the different types of mediums that people are using, like computers, digital?
I think it's all good. I mean, you know, whatever gets you to the final page, the final finished, you know, storytelling, it's fine. I mean, if you do it all digitally,
mm-hmm.
great. If you can manage to do a page with a burnt stick and a piece of wood, that's great. That's interesting. Anything is good. My process is probably a good maybe 40% digital.
Okay.
Mainly the early part of, you know, structuring a page out, you know, from, you know, doing a layout like, you know, on like my Cintiq and compositing a page. And sometimes I'll use a program called SketchUp to build backgrounds,
mm-hmm.
to make sure they're consistent, you know, and then I don't, you know, if I have to draw them over and over and over again. And then I'll basically composite a page, a layout, and then I'll print it on the board in blue. And then I tighten the drawing up by hand, and the rest of it's traditional.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, so.
And I want to talk a moment about, like, kind of the unsung heroes of comics, which are the, you know, colorists, inkers, yeah. and, you know, the letterers. Goodness. So do you know the people that are, you know, personally the people that color the pages and stuff?
Oh, yeah, generally, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I try to, to me, it's important for me to be able to talk to everybody. So I like to be able to talk to the writer I'm working with, but I also like to be able to talk with the colorist. The letterer, maybe not so much unless I have something very specific in mind.
Mm-hmm.
On the project that I'm doing now, I mean, it's kind of a, you know, I hate to use, it just sounds so, you know, kind of pompous to say it's sort of more auteurish than I normally do, but this project that I'm doing now is really, you know, I'm kind of running the whole thing.
Right.
You know, I'm writing it and I'm drawing it. I have a co-writer, but, you know, he's there to sort of help me sort of facilitate, you know, what my plan was.
Mm-hmm.
Colorist I know very well. It's Laura Martin.
Oh, nice.
Good friend of mine.
She's great.
Yeah, yeah. She was my studio mate, and she's kind of one of my go-to colorists. When I know who the letterer is, when we're that far along, I'll probably do a lot of talking to the letterer because I have ideas about, you know, certain styles and fonts and placement and that sort of thing, just a general kind of an aesthetic. But, yeah, I mean, mainly I would say visually, I talk a lot to the colorist.
Nice.
Whoever it is. It used to be, and I ink myself. That's why I've sort of left inkers out of what I'm saying right now, mainly because I haven't really worked with an inker in the last probably 10, 12 years. It's been all right. A while. I generally my own stuff. But when I used to work with an inker, I would talk a lot with the inker. But generally, it's funny because, you know, when I started, the colorist was very definitely considered kind of production.
Yeah. It
was considered, you know, part of, you know, the very end of the process, and there really wasn't a lot of personality or you know, artistic kind of expression in what the colorist was doing. And that has completely changed because of the tools available. You know, it used to be when I started, and I hate to keep doing this kind of like, oh, when I started, you know.
No, it's fine, buddy.
You know, smokers.
Well,
and blah,
Cully,
blah, blah.
You can talk however you want because you are a professional in the comics
right,
biz.
Sure.
So it's cool, man. You just go.
I have to guard myself, you know, against being the old man is kind of what I'm saying.
Okay, so everybody, Cully, I've known him for like about 3 years. He's a really awesome guy, so he's not pompous, so don't
right,
worry.
Right.
He's a great guy.
What I'm saying is that when I started, there were probably about 120 colors available.
Mm-hmm.
So when a colorist would color a book, what they do is they would take the original art and they would take a key that had like a bunch of different codes on it. And they would simply indicate where each color would go. They'd write a code on it. And then someone else would come along with something they call Ruby Lith.
Okay.
And they would cut out the area with a piece of film where that color would go. That was color separations in the late 80s, early 90s, right?
Oh, that's fascinating.
Okay, now, with the advent of computer coloring, where you use Photoshop and you have, like, a Cintiq and you have a fairly powerful computer and everything, you have 6 million colors available.
Right.
Any kind of texture you want, any kind of gradation you want, any kind of rendering that you can think of to do. If you want something to look wood grain, you just do wood grain.
Right.
You know, just anything you can think of. And what that has done is it has transformed what used to be a production process into a highly creative, artistic process.
Right.
So they're at this point, and that's why there was a big controversy a couple of years ago about wanting companies like DC to pay royalties and give cover credit to colorists, because colorists are very much more part of the creative process than they used to be, and they have fans. So
yeah.
There's absolutely no reason why someone like Laura or Dave McCaig or Matt Wilson or Brian Reber or any number of people shouldn't have, you know, credit
for
and,
it.
And get royalties for their part in making the book saleable.
Well, and on that point, you know, you said colorists now have fans. Like, you know, back in the day, if you said a colorist name, I wouldn't know who it is. But you said Laura Martin, and I'm like, oh, holy crap. She did Planetary, Astonishing X-Men. She's done, like, a lot of really cool stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, like, they're making a name for themselves. And I'm glad they're kind of stepping out from the shadows.
Well, and, you know, it used to be, like, you would, as a penciler, if you were a penciler of a comic, it was important for you to get the inker that you wanted. Because if you had the wrong inker, it could really just ruin how your art looks.
Yeah.
Right? And the colors didn't really matter that much because the colors just put down flat colors and, you know, Superman's blue and, you know, his cape is red and
that's
kind of just how it's going to be, right? But we've gotten to this point where the technology available, what you're talking about and doing digital work and everything is, and I hate to say it, but it's in large part sort of really kind of minimize the role of the inker as opposed to what it used to be, where
mm-hmm.
every penciler pretty much had to have an inker, and it's not quite as common now, and you've really just kind of boiled it down to the people who are inking comics nowadays are the best of the best.
Mm-hmm.
They have to be in order to stay in demand.
Okay.
But what we used to say basically say about, you know, you got to have the best inker, now that's kind of a lot of that's gone on to the colorist. You got to have the right colorist. You got to have a colorist that's not going to over-render your work or, you know, choose, you know, muddy colors or whatever. Somebody who's really going to contribute to...
They want it to build up your art, not, like, drown it out.
And it's like having a cinematographer. I know, you know, I know what I said a second ago about you know, making too much of, like, the comparison to film, but it really is like, you know, you want the right cinematographer, you want the right, right set decorator or whatever. And in comics, you want the right colorist for your work. And my work is you know, a little left of center. So my colorist has to be really attuned to kind of what I'm trying to do. Laura is great at it, and Laura just understands exactly what I'm doing. Dave McCaig understands exactly what I'm trying to do and just gets it.
Nice.
You know, those two in particular just really always do me a good turn. So.
Man. Yeah, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
So now we're going to take a left turn and just go, like, into comics themselves, okay. You know, not process. So can you tell me, what was your, like, I don't know, top three books you've been reading in the past, like, year? Like, what are you enjoying right now, comics-wise?
You know, it's funny, because I have not been reading nearly as much as I would like. What I have is I have a stack of things that I'm going to read.
Yeah.
You know, you see me at the comic book store every couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And I buy stuff, but it just goes into the stack. But I would say probably lately, Empress I liked a lot.
That was a really fun one.
That was good. I mean, you know, not only do I like Mark Miller a lot, but just the art is just...
Stuart Eminem's great.
Amazingly fantastic.
Yeah.
That guy, I just don't know... I just don't understand how good that guy is. I just don't even get it.
Well, I love that series. It's because it's just like a fun space opera, you know, prehistoric times. It's like almost too Star Wars-y, where it's a long time ago.
I felt the same way about the first six issues of his Star Wars book. Of Stuart's Star Wars book. That was just amazing.
Yeah.
You know, just really, really beautiful work. Just solid storytelling just on every front.
Yeah.
Perfect for the material. What else have I been enjoying? Black Panther, I like a lot. Of course, I've been checking that out because Brian Stelfreeze is an old buddy of mine, and we shared a studio for almost 20 years.
Oh, yeah, and you introduced me to him.
I did.
He's a really nice guy.
I brought him into the story. He's a great guy. Laura Martin's coloring it.
Yeah.
You know, I got to support my people.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's done an amazing job on it, just beautiful storytelling. Trying to think of what else I've been reading lately. Because to be honest, I just haven't been reading nearly as much as I would like.
Well, you're a busy man.
Well, I'm also, you know, by the time I'm done with my day, sometimes I the last thing I want to do is look at more comics. You know what I mean? It's like, and this is not a dig on comics.
Oh, but you know, if it's your job.
If you're in a kitchen all day, the last thing you want to do is cook dinner.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
It's just like the last thing you want to do is go out to eat. It's like, you know, maybe you just don't want to eat anything.
Yeah.
So, you know, a lot of times, like, when I'm done with my day, oddly enough, I, you know, when I read, I tend to read really dry, like biographies and nonfiction and that sort of thing. Or I, you know, watch television or whatever, but, you know, like, very, not nearly as often as I probably should in my reading.
Oh, I gotcha.
Yeah.
Do you have one more, or are you just going to stick with those two?
Oh, man, you're really putting me on the spot here.
It's just one more.
Let me think for a second. Actually, pretty much anything that Ed Brubaker does, I really like.
Well, like, his new series, Killer Be Killed is fantastic.
I bought them. I have not read them yet. They're in the stack.
See, I'm not going to lie. Like, I love Ed Brubaker. I love Sean Phillips. I think they're a great team. It's just, I don't really like crime comics, which it just...
I do. I love crime comics.
I mean, I buy them for my dad because he loves them. And, you know, I buy them for other people. It's just like, I'm that, you know, 80s kid where I'm just like... superheroes or really weird stuff.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. It's like, I love superheroes. I love superheroes. But I will admit that I'm a little overloaded on superheroes for the last
few years. It's very oversaturated.
Yeah. Oversaturated is probably a better term.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot. But I've been trying to, like, jump into other stuff.
If somebody does a really good superhero book, I'm all over it.
Yeah.
Like the run of Batman that Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo did.
It made me Batman again.
I thought that was one of the finest, like, most solid runs of Batman I've ever read. And that's a favorite character of mine. I love Batman. You know, it's just some of my favorite. Actually, I'm a huge Hellboy fan. As you
right.
know, I'm wearing a Hellboy t-shirt right now. I always love when Mike does Hellboy. Oddly enough, I don't like when anybody else does Hellboy. I just like when Mike does Hellboy.
I can agree with that. Like, some people...
except for Duncan Fegredo. He's the only other artist that I will accept doing Hellboy.
Yes, I can see that. I'm kind of bummed that Mignola is kind of like, you know, shelved his Hellboy work for a while. I mean, I get it. Yeah. And I've seen some of his watercolors that he's working on. It looks gorgeous. But yeah. I mean, like, come on, man. Hellboy. Like,
you know, I mean, Mike just wants to do, you know, wants to do what he wants to do for a little while.
That's yeah. just, that's and he's earned it.
Yeah.
He's earned it. But, you know, still there's some people are just like, oh, man, come on.
You know, I mean, I would bet that he would never say never. I'm sure he never has said never.
Yeah. I'm sure, like, 3 years from now, he's going to be like, okay, I got this great Hellboy story.
You never know.
Everybody comes back.
If you've been watching his process of doing the watercolors and stuff, and a couple of times he said, all right, I got dragged into doing, like, a, you know, a job or cover or something, and I got dragged into it, and I just couldn't help myself. And I, you know, I think once you do this kind of work, it's just pretty much always in your blood.
Yeah.
You know, it really is. In an odd kind of a way, there is a tribe. There's like a tribe of comic book artists. And
yeah.
even if you don't know, if you meet another comic book artist and you don't know that person very well, but you know their work and you respect their work, there is a respect there. You know,
yeah.
There's like an acknowledgement that you're both members of the tribe.
Okay, so here's something that, so I don't work in comics at all. I can draw stick figures, that's it.
Right.
And I can't write anything. But, like, so an analogy I have is I play drums. I've been playing drums forever. And there's kind of, like, a hesitant respect for, like, other really good drummers. Like, we'll look at each other and just give, like,
the
slow nod.
Yeah, yeah.
Even though we're just like, yeah, I might be able to do this a little bit better than you, but I, you know, respect.
Well, so, there's that doesn't mean that there isn't competition, and that doesn't mean that there isn't.
That's what I was getting to.
You know,
like,
does that guy think he is?
And
you know,
without naming sort of names, have you ever had like an artist where you're just like, respect, but I think I could have done that a little better? Like, don't name names. Just like, is there?
You know, I'm sure. I don't really think about it. I mean, like, I'm just glad to be kind of part of. I'm glad when I meet someone whose work I respect. And that person turns out to be a good person or a nice.
Oh, that's such a good
nice
feeling.
Guy, nice girl, you know.
Yeah.
Or if I meet someone whose work I like a lot, and they give me respect or whatever, they like what I do, and that's, you know, that's always a good feeling. And it's nice when you've grown up with someone's work,
mm-hmm.
and they turn out to be just an awesome person, like. Walt Simonson is a good example.
Oh, really? Is he nice?
Oh, man.
I'm sure he's a great person.
Walt and Wheezy are the best. Walt and Wheezy are the best. The Wrightsons are great.
Oh, yeah?
Who else? The Mignolas. I love those guys. Bill Sienkiewicz is just a big star.
I've always wanted to meet him.
He's such a great guy. You
yeah.
know? And just a lot of people like that. Howard Chaykin is someone that I've gotten to know, and he's always treated me well. And
nice.
And I usually go and see him when I'm visiting my girlfriend's parents because he lives pretty close to them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just a number of people like that. Now, it was funny. I had a conversation with Howard, and I'll be a little less profane than he was because that's Howard.
Thank you.
But we were up in someone's office at DC, and it was Howard and two or three other people, and they were all kind of like, you know, a little older than me, and kind of standing around talking, and I was there, and I was talking to Howard, and I don't know how it came up, but I mentioned to him that I had met him a lot earlier than he remembers, and he was talking to me, he goes, yeah, but you were a plebe back then. He goes, you weren't worthy of respect.
Oh, man.
And I was like, well, that's probably true. And he says, the thing is, he goes, you're an officer now. He says, back then, you were just a grunt.
Oh, know? Yeah.
And he was like, back then, we were the kind of mid-level officers.
Yeah.
And, you know, you were a private. No one cared about you. He's like, but now, he goes, you're like a colonel, and I'm a general.
Oh,
and
man.
That's how it is now. And he goes, and I can respect you because you're a soldier and you've been there.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, well, okay, I appreciate
that's,
that.
That's
and it's true. It's, I mean, you kind of
yeah.
treat them like they outrank you, but you're all officers.
Yeah, same team kind
yeah.
of thing.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I've met like quite a few people actually because of the, you know, working at the comic shop. And I got to say, like 95% of them, all been fantastically nice.
That's my experience.
Very cool.
That's my experience. Every now and then you'll meet someone who is a jerk.
Yeah, I have one in my mind. I'm not going to say names, but everybody else has been so cool. Like Scott McCloud, you, Brandon Peterson. Chip Zdarsky was fun as hell. He kept buying me beers even though I was his ride.
I think comics has a better record than humanity does. I mean, like,
yeah.
you talk about the number, the percentage of humanity that are jerks versus the percentage of comics people who are jerks.
Right.
I think comics is much better than plain old humanity.
Yeah.
Most people in comics are pretty nice.
Well, to quote, you know, Willy Wonka, you all are the dreamers of dreams, so you know, you have to be nicer. Well, we're going to take a really quick break, and we'll be back for round two as soon as I can get my phone to catch up with me. Okay, cool. Round two in just a second. Okay, so we are back for round two. So we were talking about comics you like, and I'm going to ask you, what do you think could make comics even better than they are today? I think we're in like a renaissance right now of comics. Like, there's so much good stuff.
There really is. I would not have said that 7 or 8 years ago.
Oh, agreed.
Or 10 years ago. Just comics right now are just good.
Yeah.
There's just so much good stuff. You walk down like the aisle that's got like all of the like Image and IDW and Boom mm-hmm. and just amazing, cool stuff. You walk down and look at all the, I mean even you know I'm cynical like but even the like the DC Rebirth stuff I think I've been pleasantly surprised.
It's been awesome.
How good it
it's
is.
It's been so good. I'm reading Superman again. I'm reading. I never even cared about Red Hood and the Outlaws, but that book's actually really fun. Well, Bizarro comes back.
To me, there's a major difference between the last boom we had and the boom that we're in right now. We are in a boom. We're in a boom period. The last boom that we had was when I broke in, so that was like the early 90s.
Yeah.
The difference is that the comics in the early 90s sucked.
Yeah, they did.
They were really bad.
The 90s were rough.
Sales were great.
Yeah.
You know, and if you could hold a pencil, you could break in. That kind of explains how I got in, basically. But if, you know, just the comics really, by and large, were not very good because they were cynical and they were coming from the wrong place.
Pouches, everybody's name had blood in it.
It was, at that point, it was more about, okay, this is popular, so let's copy it 100 times.
Yeah, let's make 18 X-Men books.
18 versions of whatever, and if it can't be an X-Men book, we're going to make it a thinly disguised version of an X-Men book.
Right.
And we're going to force everybody to draw in a particular style that sells really well, and it did. It sold really well.
Yeah.
For a little while.
Yeah.
And then the bottom fell out.
Oh,
and this seems a lot healthier to me. In the sense that, you know, most of the kind of independent publishers seem to have a real kind of a business plan as opposed to just, hey, X-Men is popular, let's do our version of X-Men.
Yeah.
You know? There's a lot of creativity, there's a lot of talent, there's a lot of people who are doing really interesting stuff. The business model has changed so that it's not necessarily solely dependent upon simple sales.
Yeah.
Obviously, you know, there's a merch component, there's a licensing component, there's, you know, multiple streams of distribution now that have replaced the old newsstand distribution system. You know, you've got like your backlist for, you know, trade paperbacks and hardbacks that in digital have replaced the newsstand.
Right.
Comic book stores are still there.
Mm-hmm.
The number of comic book stores seems to be coming back up. So the market is really healthy and can support a lot of stuff. So if you're asking me what comics could do to be better as an art form, as a medium, I'm not sure what the answer to that is. I mean, I think there are things that the larger companies could do to promote that a little bit more. I wish that they were a little less kind of about servicing the trademarks and had a little bit more opportunity for people to do
what they want to do,
their own stuff.
Yeah.
You know, you look at something like Vertigo, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Vertigo is just not what it was. And there was a point where it was the place where DC creators or other creators could go and do stuff with DC's characters.
Right, but it could be like weird and crazy or ultra violent.
Yeah. And now it seems much more of a creator-owned imprint, but the problem is that why do creator-owned work at Marvel or DC when you could do it at Image and you can own the whole thing?
Well, and you know? Here's what I've been hearing from like customers as well as, you know, these are my opinions as well.
Right.
Things that I think that could, you know, be better is, you know, for the larger companies, DC and Marvel, And everybody's heard this, event fatigue. Like, I'm so sick and tired.
I totally agree.
I'm so sick. Like, because poor, you know, artists and writers, they're stuck there just like, oh, well, I got to tie it into this now, and there goes my cool original idea.
There is that, and I've run into that, and you know, my whole career, where you have to basically stop and service some big event
that
gooses sales in the short term rather than building long-term sales by just doing really good stuff.
Yeah. Right?
There's that, and you know, this. What I'm going to say here is a little controversial.
That's fine.
In that, as great as they were, as amazing stuff as earlier generations were able to do, what is expected, the level of detail and the level of work that goes into doing a modern 2016 comic. And what is expected from your editor and you know, expected by your editor and what is expected by large publishers is not conducive to doing a monthly schedule.
Okay. Elaborate a little bit.
Most of the people that I know that do what is considered really commercial artwork nowadays can maybe pull off about 6 to 8 issues a year of something.
Okay.
It used to be you had like, you know, well, I mean... At the top of the food chain, you had Jack Kirby, who could do, they refer to the Kirby barrier. I think at one point he was doing something like 6 books every month.
Goosh.
And I, you know, I just can't imagine that.
Yeah.
As much as I love Jack Kirby, as much as Jack Kirby was the king of comics, most artists nowadays would not be hired doing the level of detail he was doing.
Right.
You know, doing...
Everybody's faces always look the same.
Very, and... you know, grid-like, you know, panel layouts and not a whole lot of detail or rendering or whatever. And, you know, nowadays there is a certain expectation of what is commercial. And you know, most artists can't pull that off on a monthly basis. There are exceptions. There are always exceptions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you got your... You got your John Romita Juniors who can do a couple of books a month if called upon to do it, but you know, yeah, it's just very difficult to pull that off. You know, Greg Capullo is amazing and is great,
yeah,
and can do a monthly book. He's rare,
yeah.
You know, I think a lot of people can't, and that's why I think you're seeing a lot more arc based storytelling in comics nowadays, and you're seeing stuff that's made to fit within like a trade paperback format. So like six issue arcs, and then they bring somebody else on. They don't want people to do
long run
40 issues of something anymore. Very rarely do they.
Which
want that.
Is another thing that I kind of miss from my, you know.
I miss it too.
I miss it so bad. Like, oh, just like these two guys, they did 5 years of amazing stuff.
Look, when I was growing up, I was a huge New Teen Titans fan, so right. I wanted my Wolfman Perez fix every month, and I got it.
Yeah.
I know, as an artist, I can't do that. I used to talk to, there was a letterer named John Costanza that I used to do a lot of work with back in the early 2000s, and John had been around since the 60s, and this was back when comics were hand-lettered. And he used to tell me all the stories about, you know, Gil Kane and you know, all these, you know, kind of big artists of the day. And, you know, it was interesting to find out that a lot of those guys, you know, you always hear the stories about, you know, artists back in the day, they were never late. And that's actually not true at all.
Right.
He would actually say, oh, yeah, Gil Kane was late all the time. He had to be, you know, they had to do fill-ins all the time. And, you know, and they, you know... Just not to pick on Gil Kane, but just using him as an example, it was a different industry back then, but it was very much the same industry in a lot of ways. And the level of what people want to see nowadays is just, it is so crushing as just far as the amount of work that goes into it.
Oh yeah.
And you know, some people can get away with developing a simpler style that sort of works stylistically, but most people don't. You know, most artists in comics don't.
Well, and like the best example I can think of is David Aja. His artwork in the Immortal Iron Fist book was just gorgeous.
Yeah.
And then he went over to Hawkeye, and you know, I know this is heresy to a lot of people, but you know, I liked the Iron Fist book better because the art was better. Matt Fraction was on time with releasing the scripts, and then he simplified his work so much for Hawkeye.
I don't know him. Okay, I don't know him. I've never met him.
Oh, me neither.
Okay, but I would be willing to bet that doing that Iron Fist book was crushing.
Oh, yeah.
Was very difficult for him to do. I'd be willing to bet that he was thinking, oh my God, what can I do to keep doing a monthly and not kill myself so that I have to work 14 or 15 hours a day, not have weekends, not have holidays, not have any time to spend with my family or whatever.
Right.
And I would be willing to bet that he thought, you know, if I could do smaller panels in a simpler style and do, you know, 20 small panels that are easier to draw and somehow figure out how to tell the story in an interesting way doing that, then that would be, that would mean that I can maybe have a Saturday every now and then.
Well, see, this is a more practical answer than one of my coworkers said. Oh, well, it's just a simpler story, so the artwork needs to be simpler. I mean, and I was like, look,
the thing is, I'm sure that that figures into it too. I mean, there are a lot of different variables, but I mean, I have been trying to crack the nut of how to work faster, work more efficiently, get the work done for a long time, and I haven't quite been able to crack it. You know, it's like I can in spurts do a lot of work. I mean, there have been times I've done 10 pages in a week, pencils and inks, which is a lot. I mean,
that's
half a book in a week.
Oh yeah.
In time, let me put it this way: the normal time it takes to pencil and ink a book is more like 6 to 7, or maybe even 8 weeks.
Okay. Goosh.
So having been someone who has done half of a book in a week, that means sleeping for 2 hours.
Yeah, I bet that was killing you, man.
And not being able to go anywhere, and not being able to take much time out to even eat.
Yeah.
And that was hard when I was 25. And I'm creeping up on 50 now, and it's still hard. And it's harder actually than it's ever been.
Mm-hmm.
And I find it a lot harder to go without sleep now and that sort of thing. So, yeah, there's always that sort of effort, that pressure to try to figure out a simpler way to do things and yet not compromise that
quality.
I don't even know if it's necessarily quality, just what is stylistically acceptable now. Because I would never say that, you know, Steve Ditko lacked quality. You know, I would never say Jack Kirby lacked quality. Obviously, there was a quality.
I meant like personal quality, like to your standards.
Right, but I mean that standard is somewhat dictated by what's acceptable, you know, in today's market. And today's market's just different. And you know, there is a reason why, in the 1960s, for example, and that started to change in the 70s when Neil Adams came in. But in the 1960s, why artists could do so many more pages because you know, and so you know, could do a couple of books a month because you had an audience that was mostly children who weren't quite as discerning back then.
Right.
And the style that they were doing was just a lot simpler. And it was a lot closer to what you would call traditional cartooning than what it has evolved into nowadays.
Right, right.
Which is closer to illustration.
So, and going on the, you know, fact that you were saying just a couple of minutes ago about, you know, getting things out on time, one thing that I think, and please correct me if I'm wrong, I think there's a lack of, I'm trying to think of the best way to put it, accountability in comics sometimes from artists and writers.
In what sense?
So, for example, you know, in Marvel and DC, they have an editorial board, got to get these books out, make the story. But, like, an Image, for example, Jonathan Hickman's The Dying and the Dead did 3 issues, nothing happened. Brian Hitch's Real Heroes did 5 issues, supposed to have the grand finale, never happened. And he just went and worked on something else. God, what else? Warren Ellison, John Cassidy's last issue of Planetary, which took like, what, 5 years and stuff?
Well, I don't know this.
I don't know the artist writer side of it.
Well, excuse me. I don't know that it necessarily can be broken down to something as simple as a lack of accountability. I don't know what accountability is, especially when it comes to a creator-owned book.
Mm-hmm.
I know for a fact that on the last issue of Planetary, because I know Warren.
Okay, yeah, please, fill me in.
I know Warren's having a lot of health problems.
Oh, shit, yeah, that's right.
So he was having a lot of health problems. Hey, watch your language.
I know, man, sorry, everybody. Sorry, Mom.
He was having a lot of health problems at the time because that was He was doing a lot of work at that point, but I know, I mean, Warren has been kind of beset by a lot of health problems over the years.
Right.
But at that time, it's like, you know, I mean, you can spin it as kind of a lack of accountability, but is it worth his health to...
Well, I mean, and maybe I was doing a poor choice of words.
For somebody like Brian Hitch or somebody like Jonathan Hickman, if they're doing a creator-owned book and they do three issues and it becomes clear that they're not making a living doing it, what are they supposed to do? You know what I mean? It's like if someone offers you a lifeline like, hey, you want to do Justice League for a little while and you don't have to worry about, you don't have to lose your shirt on the book, you can make a rate.
Well, maybe this is the spoiled fanboy in me that is just like, just finish your story.
It's true, and I agree. I mean, like, I want to read the
end of
the story.
I mean, there's TV shows that have done this to me as well.
But I would, I'll venture that somebody like Jonathan Hickman or somebody like Brian Hitch are probably just as, if not more, disappointed that they have not been able to finish those things.
All right.
And you also have to think about the fact that these are people probably with families that have kids. I know for a fact Brian Hitch has kids. He's got mouths to feed. The book, if being creatively satisfied is not making him money, you got to make money. You know,
you've humanized them. Oh,
yeah,
man.
I mean, it's you know, I mean, you got to do. I mean, like me for example, I don't have kids. You know, my girlfriend's not dependent upon me to put food in her mouth or anything like that.
Right.
But like, I have obligations that I agreed to with DC that I am going to finish if it kills me before I run off and do a creator owned thing. And it's fully my intention to do some creator owned work, but I have to finish this project that I'm on first.
Right.
And that's just how I am. But if it were a reversed situation where I were doing a creator owned thing
and it wasn't paying the bills,
I'm sorry if somebody offers me, you know, a run on Batman with a big name writer that's gonna, you know, if somebody said, hey, you want to do DK3, I'd be like, hell yes, I want to do DK3. And I'll come back to this other book when I can.
I would love to see your artwork on DK3.
Well, either way. But I mean, you know, there are practical considerations, and it isn't always just about, you know, people, I think people kind of, this is another thing that I've talked to, like with other artists and writers. Which is, and social media is like a big culprit in this.
Oh, yeah.
You have your favorite characters, right? And you have your favorite creators. But really what it boils down to is those creators to you are characters also. So you look at them in terms of like moving them around on a chessboard, or you want to put this creator on this character, and it really just becomes, you know, pieces that you're playing with. And you don't consider the fact that, you know, the characters aren't living, but the creators are.
Yeah.
And very often I find that people just don't think of it that way. They look at somebody like Warren Ellis, or they look at somebody like Jim Lee.
And they have mythos around
them. Or Dan DiDio. When people call for like Dan DiDio to be fired, they're using it in the same tone that they say, I want Darkseid out of that book. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They're not thinking about any consequences that, you know, Dan may have, you know, like mouths to feed, or Dan may have obligations, or someone may have a sick parent they're taking care of, or no one ever thinks about that.
Right.
So it's like people, I really wish that people would sort of think about the fact that, you know, your favorite creator has a life, and your favorite creator has obligations and has family, and, you know, it isn't just as easy as give me my book now. You know, there's very much a desire, I'm sure, on the part of every creator that does a book, whether it's creator-owned or whether it's work for hire or whatever, to do the work and do it really well so that you enjoy it. But sometimes stuff just doesn't work out like that.
Yeah.
It's just how it is.
Oh, man. Well, I didn't mean to, you know,
no. I mean, you're not offending me. I'm just explaining it kind of the best way. And I've had these discussions with other creators
before. Well, see, and a lot of us, you know, on the lowest level, the readers, we don't get this humanity to the creators.
Well, sure,
you know?
I mean, but that's what I mean when it's like, it's sort of like, you know, people tend to look through the prism of characters.
Well, here's my point of view from it. You know, growing up in the 80s and 90s, comic book writers and artists, they became kind of like rock stars in their own right. And so, just like with, you know, oh man, Van Halen should get back together with the original group, or Black Sabbath, or Led Zeppelin, you know. And
that's a great analogy.
And then, like, you know, they've made themselves into these giant rock stars.
Right.
And so we're all just like, I'm the fan. You should give me what I want now because I give you money. And that's unfair. It's unfair to demand that from people.
But on the other side of it, you know, is if you can do the work and you're in a position to be able to do it and you're committed to doing it, you should do it.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, and I, you know, when it comes to the whole thing of like, you know, creators as characters, creators do that too. I mean, creators look at fans as like a monolith. Like, it's fans. There's this big group out there, and they're called fans.
Yeah, this nebulous void of fans.
Yeah, and they're either going to support me or they're not going to support me. And that's one of the reasons I like going to conventions a lot, because then you talk to people. You know, you people come up and you have conversations, and you talk about, you know, what they like to read and what you like to write and draw, and whether or not that you know, kind of works together, and, you know, what they want out of your work, and you know.
Yeah.
The cool thing is, I mean, like, a number of, I was just talking to, Jimmy Palmiotti just made this point the other day about how a lot of people who started out as fans have become his really good friends. It's the same with me. I mean, I've got, like, a number of really good friends that I met because they came up to get an autograph from me. And, you know, now we go out to dinner when we're at conventions and, you know, exchange Christmas cards and talk on the phone and, you know, we're yeah. pals. I mean, that's a good thing. That's what I like. But, and it sort of is a hedge against treating people like they are a monolithic entity.
Well, I'll always buy you a beer if I ever see you in a bar. So we're going to take a break, and then we're going to go to the last segment of round three, and then I want you to think about this one while we're taking a break.
Okay.
So you've made it, and you get to decide what you're going to write, what you're going to draw, like what is your top three projects, and I know that you probably thought about this, the okay. top three projects that you have always wanted to do and you have complete. You can either choose the writer, choose the artist, choose whatever you want. So, I want you to think about this.
And these have to be work-for-hire, like, characters that you know, right?
Or it could be your own creative-owned project, whichever you...
I'm not gonna tell you any creator-owned stuff just because that would mean that I'd be telling you about something I haven't done yet.
Okay, so, cool, yeah. So let's... However you want to do it.
Okay.
So, okay, so we're going to take a break, and then we'll be back for round three. Okay, we're back. Sorry, we were just discussing daylight savings time and how much it's horrible.
And drummers.
So, Cully might have had some time to think after talking Axl Rose. We were talking music for quite a bit. So, is there any projects of licensed characters that you've ever really wanted to work on that you were just like, you could either be the artist or the writer, and who would you work with to do it? You get free reign.
Okay, that part of the question you didn't give me before the break.
Okay, well, I'm horrible.
Look, I haven't done my Batman run yet. That I would, which is not to say I haven't done Batman before.
Right.
I've done Batman projects before. I did a project called Batman Tenses back in the early 2000s with Joe Casey.
Mm-hmm.
It was the best I could do at the time, but I just feel like I could do better. You know, I did some Batman not too long ago with Ron Mars, but
mm-hmm.
I just haven't done the Batman project I want to do yet.
Do you have like a story arc in mind, or you just want to work on it?
I would just love to hook up with a great writer, and I would love to, you know, work like with somebody like Scott Snyder. I think is amazing. I think he's a really good writer and obviously knows the character.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to, I love Daredevil.
Yeah.
I've always been a big fan of Daredevil. I would love a shot at that character. And again, I've done a couple of issues of Daredevil in my career.
All right.
But it was one of those things, and this, you know, this was a thing that used to happen to me all the time, where I'd get a shot at doing like a character that I loved, but it would be the arc that they did where someone lost their powers and was out of costume the whole time. And,
oh, lame.
Or, you know, and it's like I did this run in Daredevil right before Joe Quesada took it over years ago.
Before the Marvel Knights stuff.
Right, and it was written by Scott Lobdell, and it was like, you know, it was a Daredevil had amnesia, and he had somehow, for some reason, was in France, and his face had been altered, and he wasn't in costume.
All right.
And I'm like, so I'm doing Daredevil in that the logo is on the book, but I'm not doing Daredevil because he's not Daredevil. He's living in France.
He is Jacques Murdoch.
Hey!
Which would be an awesome punk band
but,
name.
But this has happened to me so many times where it's like, hey, you want to do the issue of Superman where he's not in, I mean, not that specifically that.
So you're always the incognito kind of, artist.
Or at least for a long time it was that way. Not so much the last few years, but, I love the big characters like Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman. Anytime anybody wants me to do that stuff, that's great.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, I love Daredevil. I've never gotten a proper shot at Captain America.
Okay.
Again, I've done a couple of issues of Captain America over the years, but it just, again, was not optimum.
You know?
But if there's one character,
I'm ready.
That I would love to do.
I'd love to see this.
I would love to just really do a job on it. Is Shazam.
Okay. Captain Marvel.
Captain Marvel. Billy Batson. I love Captain Marvel. I love the big red cheese.
I do as well.
One of my favorite characters since I was a very, very small child. I don't have a take. I don't have, like, you know, a thing that I think you have to do with this character. I actually thought that the Geoff Johns, Gary Frank run was actually pretty good. And
I own it. I thought it was great.
I didn't actually, to be honest, I didn't kind of want it to be good. I sort of wanted it to be, you know, yet another failed attempt at doing that character.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, my knee-jerk reaction was, you know, his name's not Shazam. That's the wizard. The wizard's name is Shazam.
Right.
His name is Captain Marvel. But I thought what they did was pretty good. I actually really liked it.
Well, I loved how they brought in, like, they expanded the Marvel family. You know, it wasn't just Mary Marvel and Talkie Tawny. You know, right. It was just like, oh, let's bring in, you know, some other people. And I liked the costume designs and everything. But honestly, I think my favorite interpretation of Shazam, Captain Marvel, was Jeff Smith's Shazam and the Monster Society of Evil.
Yeah.
Because it was like that young wish fulfillment of, like, I'm a little kid and I can be a superhero.
Yeah.
Because ultimately that's what he is. He's wish fulfillment to me.
Yeah.
He's just like,
I feel like if there's one thing that anybody who does the character nowadays has a high risk of missing,
mm-hmm.
it's the whimsy.
Yeah.
Of the original character. And when I say, you know, whimsy, I don't mean making it dated. I mean, you can do a modern whimsy.
Yeah.
But I think you can do it. I mean, I think you could, you know, with the right writer, you know, somebody who gets the character and the right artist, you can restore that in a modern context and it would work.
Yeah.
But it really is, it's alchemy. You know, you got to have the right writer and the right artist and the right combination, and you have to have a publisher willing to let you go out on a limb.
Well, and I think that's what makes the best comics is, as you put it, the alchemy. Like, it
I think
has
so
to,
too. I think so too.
There's been so many things that, when it's the right writer and the right artist and everything, it makes pure magic. Or it just turns into, like, it could be an artist that you love and a writer that you love, and it just doesn't turn out that well.
Well, that's because what's missing there is the atmosphere of trust.
Right.
The right talented people and the right combination of people to work on a particular character or a book or whatever, and you have that atmosphere of mutual respect and trust,
mm-hmm.
and that comes from the top down, from the publisher down to everybody else. That's when it works.
Yeah.
You know? Which is not to say that you can't get good comics out of a bunch of people who fight constantly, because, I mean, that's happened too. But
true.
A character like Captain Marvel, you really do have to have, I think, that kind of the right mix and the right circumstances to make that work. And the right take. I think there needs to be a take.
Okay, I get you.
But yeah, that's a character I've always aspired to do. I was really jealous when I saw just recently, or about a year ago, the Convergence Shazam stuff.
Right, right.
That, it was just such a beautiful run. It was still only
two issues, yeah.
But it was just, I just looked at it and I was like, I loved it and I hated it at the same time, because I was kind of like, my God, I wish I could do it this well.
I think the Grant Morrison Multiversity, like that one issue, Thunderworld,
yeah.
Did you read that?
I didn't.
Oh, it was so.
Which is funny, because I did a cover for it. I didn't actually read it.
So
I know it's terrible to admit that.
No, that's totally fine. So the multiversity thing was I loved it because, you know, I like weird DC. I like right, it when yeah. DC is allowed to just like go freaking crazy.
Yeah.
And so they did an issue called Thunderworld where yeah. it was like the Fawcett Comics kind of thing, and it was just like Jeff Smith's Shazam and the Monster Society of Evil. It was just like hopeful and whimsy, as you put it, yeah. and it was just like, I hesitate to use the word heartwarming, but it was just like, oh yeah, this is what superhero should be. It's just like what, hopeful and good.
What's great, if you ever go back and read the old Fawcett comics mm-hmm. from the 40s and 50s, the Captain Marvel adventures and stuff,
yeah.
the Marvel family and all that stuff, they're really weird.
I mean, love the weird stuff.
You got a genius worm with a radio on his chest.
Yeah, Mr. Mind.
Controlling people's minds. That's weird.
He's and
so embrace the weird. You know,
yeah. Why don't they do that anymore? Like, DC did a little 6-issue miniseries that was 80 pages each issue. That Legends of Tomorrow thing, and they like brought back Metamorpho, and I'm like, oh yeah, cool, Metamorpho, because yeah. those old comics were freaking weird.
And you know, what's funny is if you look at like a lot of the current like the CW shows, the DC CW shows.
I gotta give them some props, man. They're awesome.
They are doing the comics kind of that I grew up with.
Yeah, they're doing great stuff.
And it's because all the people that are doing those shows are my age, and they read the same stuff.
Yeah,
growing up, and they're reproducing that on television because we finally gotten to the point where technologically, it's cheap enough.
To do that stuff. To have somebody's head on fire and make Firestorm.
Yeah, right? And it's like, you know, they spent all these years trying to do big budget films with these characters. And in order to do a big budget film, you have to have a big story. You have to have a big, you know, kind of sometimes sort of a brainless, like a story with like a big event.
Yeah.
To justify all the money being spent on it. But on television, you're able to spread the story out over a bunch of episodes,
right.
like they used to do when I was a kid.
Yeah, yeah.
And it works.
So, this was something I talked about with the last person I talked with, hey, Jose. So, how do you feel about the movies and the TV? I think that the TV stuff, including Netflix, has been amazing for comic readers. You know, I just finished the second season of The Flash. I just started Arrow. I know I'm like 6 years too late for that, but I'm just starting it now. And honestly, I'm not going to lie. I never gave a damn about Green Arrow. I just never could. It wasn't for me.
I like Green Arrow.
Well, good. I mean, and...
But you know what's funny about... What you're seeing on, like, Arrow and what you're seeing on Supergirl and... Arrow is a Batman show.
It's a Batman show, but it also reminds me of, do you remember Green Arrow Year One with Andy Diggle and Jock?
I do.
Yeah, like, it seems like that.
Right, but in terms of structure, in terms of what they're doing...
Oh, it's straight up Batman.
It's a straight up Batman
show.
Oh,
yeah.
You know, the millionaire with,
The League of Assassins.
The League of Assassins and Ra's al Ghul and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And it's flat out a Batman show, they just can't use Batman.
They can't use Batman.
Right? And if you look at Supergirl...
I haven't seen that yet. Is it good?
Supergirl, I really like Supergirl.
Okay.
But
it just seems so charming.
It's very charming. It's like, it's so charming it hurts. It's amazing how charming it is. They do superheroes so well.
I almost spit out my beer.
But
sorry.
What you got is, you've got the superhero character who is a nerdy person that wears glasses in her normal everyday identity. Works at a media company. You know, for a gruff boss,
yeah.
and has an unrequited love at work,
mm-hmm.
and so on and so forth. They're doing a Superman show. They're not doing Supergirl,
right?
As she has been presented in the comics over the years,
right?
They're doing, you know, she's Clark Kent. She's, you know, she's Supergirl, and you know, Jimmy Olsen is Lois Lane, and Cat Grant is Perry White, and the place where they work is essentially the Daily Planet, you know, and. You know what I mean? It's like, so they're not doing a Supergirl show. What they're doing is they couldn't at least at first really do a Superman show,
mm-hmm.
they hung Supergirl on it.
Yeah.
The only show of those, of the CW shows that seems to be straight up its source material is The Flash.
Yeah.
And And I like The Flash a lot. I think it's a good show.
It's really good. Like, yeah. I was so hesitant for, God, years. Like, at least 2 years. I was just like, you know, I'm not the biggest Flash fan, whatever.
I was a huge Flash fan.
It wasn't for me. Yeah. And then one of my coworkers, he just kept badgering me. And then I just, like, said, okay, fine, I'll watch the first episode. So 9 hours later,
right.
I was on, you know, episode 10. And I was just like, oh, my God, they brought in the Pied Piper and Firestorm. And, like, the reason why I love it is they're bringing back all these, like, C-list characters, which I think DC has, you know, Marvel has great A-list and B-list characters. Their C and D list is horrible. But DC, they have great A through F characters.
Yes. Yeah.
Like, King Shark shows up. I'm like, right. Yeah, cool. Giant man shark. Let's do it.
They brought in Grodd. I mean,
Grodd showed up.
How would you know, in as recently as 5 or 6 years ago, they wouldn't even think of doing that.
Yeah, Grodd. And, like, he was genuinely menacing and scary. Yeah. I mean, like, I don't want to be in a sewer with a gorilla.
Yeah.
I
mean, who would?
They even brought in, like, a little allusion to Metamorpho with Simon Stagg showing up.
Well, I'm not caught up, just so you know.
This isn't, like, episode 3.
Of which season?
The first one.
Okay.
William Sadler, the guy.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah, that was Simon Stagg, and that was, you know, Metamorpho's boss. So I really hope that happens, because I'm a huge Metamorpho fan. Yeah. And
well, what we have nowadays is we have an embarrassment of riches. I mean, like, I can't watch every show. It really, I like The Flash a lot. I like Supergirl a lot. I have liked Arrow, although I'm starting to kind of fall out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't like Gotham. I have not liked Gotham very much.
You know, my whole idea about Gotham was like, hey, cool, let's have a Batman show, but not have Batman. Or anything remotely close to it. Let's have a police procedural that the Penguin shows up in.
Right.
Like, I loved Ed Brubaker's, you know, Gotham Central book.
Ed Brubaker, yeah.
Yeah, I thought, oh, that might kind of be what it is.
Right, but even then, there's a difference between doing a Batman book or a Gotham book without Batman, but Batman exists.
Yeah.
And doing a Gotham book or a Gotham story
before
with all of the milieu of Gotham. And it's 10 years before Batman even shows up.
Yeah, and like,
I'm like, what?
I just don't get it. And I mean, like, you know, God bless him. I hope they do some cool stuff. But also, there's like a ton of Joker fake outs that happen like constantly through it. Yeah. I've seen like 4 episodes, and each one it was like, this guy could be the Joker.
Yeah.
And I'm like, all right, I guess. I always thought the Joker was younger than Batman, but he might be this 27-year-old guy when Bruce is 10. You can only do a fake-out
so long.
Yeah.
That's one of the problems I had with Lost.
Oh, God.
Lost was I just got so tired of the fake-outs. I got tired of the, oh, something's about to happen. It's nothing.
Oh, you see the smoke monster? It's actually just this old dude hanging out on a beach.
It's nothing.
You know, and
that gets really old after a while.
So we talked about the DC stuff. So what do you think about the, you know, like, Marvel Netflix stuff? How do you feel about that?
I love it.
Every single one of them?
I mean, like, I've not watched Luke Cage yet.
It's pretty awesome.
I really, really like the first season of Daredevil. I really like about 75% of the second season of Daredevil. I thought it started really slow.
It did.
And I didn't particularly love the ending. But pretty much from the time Elektra shows up until almost the last episode, I was enthralled.
I love that they actually got a lady that sounded Greek playing Elektra.
She was great.
Yeah.
And she was flat out, I mean, she was what I wanted Elektra to be. Maybe not necessarily, like, you know, visually quite so much, but she just had the attitude down.
The attitude was perfect. And here's one thing I've been telling everybody about the Marvel Netflix stuff, is whoever's doing the casting, they deserve an Oscar.
I know. You're preaching to the choir here. I thought Jessica Jones was good, although I thought there were too many episodes.
I
felt like you could have had a really strong 6 or 7 episode series. You know, I thought it was maybe 3 episodes too long.
So this might be heresy as well. I am not a fan of the Bendis Gatos Alias series. Yeah. I tried it. I've tried 3 times to get to it, get through it. I'm like, I just don't care.
I used to read it. I mean, that was a really good period in Marvel, I thought. It was when Quesada first kind of took over.
Yeah.
And, like, the, you know, X-Men suddenly got really good. And,
yeah. I mean, and don't get me wrong. Yeah. If other people like it, that's great. It's just, it's not for me. I either, like, as I said many times earlier, super weird comics or, like, straight up, like, superhero craziness.
Yeah.
And it was just like, oh, okay, this, you know, Private Eye, and she's, you know, she's a drunk, and like, oh, cool, that reminds me about half the people I know in college, you know. So it just wasn't for me. So when I was hesitant to watch the Jessica Jones show, and I was like, and also Kristen Ritter, I was just like, that girl that was Don't Trust the Bee in Apartment 23 or whatever it was, it's like, I don't get it. And then I start watching the show.
Yeah, you're like, I remember her when she was choking on her own vomit and Breaking Bad.
Yeah, so, and I was just like, I don't know how I feel about this. And then, like, I start watching it. And then when I realized that her friend Trish was Patsy Walker Hellcat,
right,
I started going crazy with theories. I was like, oh, man,
yeah,
they're going to bring in Hellstorm because that she was married to Hellstorm, and then this will bring the cosmic and, magic stuff.
The cop that she ended up dating turned out
was
to be Nuke.
Yeah.
Right, yeah, exactly.
As soon as I was like, Simpson, that sounds so familiar. Yeah,
give me a red.
Yeah, and then, and then I was like, oh my god, they brought a Nuke, and it's in Daredevil. That makes total sense. Yeah. And he was great in that.
Yeah, like I said, there was, I thought, much like the second season of Daredevil, I thought, you know, it was strong enough to support about maybe 6, 7, 8 episodes. Not quite strong enough to support 10 episodes.
Man, I kind of wish they did, they cut it, the whole season in half, one way and in the other. Like, the first half, Punisher. Second half, Elektra.
Yeah.
But they kept kind of, like, mixing it.
And that's fine. I mean, you know, and I also thought that the Punisher stuff, once they got past, like, the first 5 episodes, actually got really
interesting. Dude, John Bernthal killed it.
Oh, he was great.
Oh.
He was great.
Yeah, sorry, Tom Jane and, you know, Dolph Lundgren.
No, he was fantastic. I thought he really was. And what's funny is it's not like he's a big dude.
No.
But he felt big.
He just doesn't quit, and he carries himself.
Big. Yeah. Yeah, he carries himself like a big dude.
Yeah.
I really appreciate him. And I think that the, what's his name that plays Matt Murdock?
Charlie Cox.
Charlie Cox is just, he's Matt Murdock.
Yeah, well, like,
he's flat out. I mean, he's not like he's got the red hair or any of that, or the strawberry colored hair or whatever. He just is the character.
Yeah, he has that. And I know this sounds weird, underwhelming confidence. Like, you know, he's acting all humble, but you know he could beat your ass kind of thing. Like,
also, he's Irish
and very Irish. So, like, I'm very happy with that. I can't wait for Iron Fist. Oh my god.
Yeah.
Ugh.
I have not watched Luke Cage yet.
Watch Luke Cage.
I haven't had a chance, but I like Mike Coulter a lot. I remember him from The Good Wife.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
He was really good on that show.
Dude, the soundtrack is...
Yeah.
Good God, it's awesome. Yeah. Like, and the theme song's great. And all the villains, the guy who plays Cottonmouth, and I'm not giving away any spoiler for you because you haven't seen it.
You watch it.
I'm not saying anything, but he has this thing is when he's like a crime boss, obviously. And whenever somebody insults him, he just, like, kind of laughs in their face. And whenever he does that, I'm just like, oh, man, you guys are screwed. He's laughing now.
Well, thanks for the spoiler.
Yes, I spoiled it 100% for you. So I guess this is a good time to wrap up. But do you have anything you want to promote? Are you on Twitter? Are you doing anything?
I am on Twitter. You can find me at just Cully Hamner on, like, at Cully Hamner on Twitter.
And it's Hamner.
Hamner. H-A-M is in mother, N is in Nancy, E-R.
Yeah, not Hammer, not Hamner.
Hamner. Okay. You know what? Actually, here's something I will promote.
Okay, I'm ready.
I did a page in the Love is Love anthology, which is the Orlando benefit.
Which is awesome.
Definitely grab that book.
Yeah.
It's for a good cause, and there's a lot of amazing creators involved.
Well, explain it for everybody who doesn't know what it is.
Well, you know, there was the shooting in the nightclub in Orlando months ago, and this is meant to raise money to help the victims of the shooting. And it's a co-venture between IDW and DC, and it's kind of shepherded by Mark Andrako, who's a writer that I think a lot of people know. It's just a good cause, and I think it's not only is it a good cause, but it promotes, acceptance, and I just think that it's something that's worthwhile for all of us to do.
Yeah.
So if you want me to promote something, I can't really promote what I'm working on right now, because it just not ready to promote yet, but I would love to promote that because I think it's worthwhile.
Okay, excellent. That is a very good cause, and I know a couple other people are working on it, and I'm very excited about it because I'm going to get a copy.
Yeah.
I think it's awesome. So anything else? Any other things you want to talk about?
I think we're tapped out.
All right, cool. Well, you can.
Hey, that's a beer pun.
Oh man, beer pun! Hey! You're just full of them. That's great. So I've been talking with Coley Hamner. He's the one that came up with the title of this because he's awesome. Our co-star is Bernie the dog, who's jingle jangling around.
Say goodbye, Bernie.
Bernie's not saying goodbye. Oh, maybe a little bit.
A little bit of sniff there.
That's fine. And yeah, so you can follow me at SuperTyDenton1. And if you ever want to be on this podcast, you can talk to me at the shop or you can email me at info@austinbooks. Just put attention tie. I will see it, TY. And yeah, cool. So, Coley, thank you so much for being a part of this.
Well, thanks for coming over and thanks for talking to me.
Of course. Well, and we'll catch you guys.
Very lonely.
Oh, my God. I'll come by next Monday. Okay, guys, we'll catch you next time and thank you for joining us.
All right.
Hang on. Oh, my God. My phone's not. I'm such a professional here. Okay, cool. So, we'll catch you guys next time. Bye.